Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey guys, it's Oren and Matt this time.
Hello.
We are here with another disclaimer, because the world is crazy.
You guys, it's moving real fast. So we're recording this on Wednesday, March 18th, deep into self-quarantine and shelter in place. What do they call it?
Yeah, shelter in place, I think.
Shelter in place, there you go.
Wait, what day of quarantine are you on, Matt?
I'm on day six.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I'm on day six. Really six and a half. Basically, so when we were recording this episode, I was about to go shoot. Basically, from that shoot on, I was in self-quarantine. My wife had one client that she spoke to in person. We're deep into it at this point.
Right. My wife was acting in a McDonald's commercial on Friday of March, Friday the 13th. But I saw someone post something on Facebook or Instagram that said, what day you think it is of the quarantine says a lot about who you are.
That is true. Yeah. Yeah, I basically was like, that's a wrap. Bye, the world. I haven't really left since the 19th, which is, 6 days ago.
What's the work outlook?
Well, I'm still in post on that job that we just shot, so that's great. Everything else has evaporated. Everything else, you know, I would get hit up for things, but it's all postponed until we are back.
Do you feel like these post jobs are kind of like taking their sweet time? Because no one wants to be unemployed.
I'm giving it a little more TLC, or rather I can give it as much TLC as I want, which is really nice. I did a Zoom meeting today that worked out really well. It was a little laggy on playback, but for the most part was really awesome. And so I was able to session with our editor, and you know, it's been pretty good.
And is your editor working from home?
He is indeed, yes. Yeah, I think everybody's working from home. Though we had our post call yesterday. No, it was just this morning. And Nick from Sawhorse was leading the call, and he was like, hey, sorry guys, I've been talking to the client back and forth, and we have to do an in-studio session next week. And there was just dead silence from everyone. And then he was like, no, I'm just kidding. But he got us good. Like, we were like, wait, what?
Well, that is such a thing that Nick would say.
It was a good joke. It was legitimately excellent.
Well, that is hilarious. So I don't know, is there anything else to say, or should we just get into this episode?
I mean, just like it's interesting to listen to this episode because we are children of the summer.
Yeah. Oh, I guess I will say this because I'm curious. There's like two types of people that are taking the coronavirus quarantine seriously. I think there's people that aren't taking it seriously, who are a different breed. But if you're one of the people that is taking it seriously, there's a type of people that are kind of like glued to the news. And if it's not coronavirus related, they're not that interested in it. You know, like I started watching McMillions last night and I'm like, yeah, I guess some guy stole $1 million from McDonald's. Who cares? Like, the world is ending, you know? But then there's the people that are just looking for an escape. Like, oh, I learned to play piano and I'm learning French and I read all of Dostoevsky or whatever because I have all this free time. And so I'm curious if our listeners like the podcast as an escape, if you guys are escaping into podcasts and other stories and hearing about filmmakers and hearing about interesting interviews and interesting topics, or if you are preferring to just listen to the news, like the New York Times podcast and those types of podcasts right now? Like, what is interesting you in this time? Because it will affect what we talk about on the podcast if you give us that feedback. So you can email us, justshootitpod@gmail.com, or you can tweet at us or send us a message on Instagram or wherever. We're justshootitpod on all social media.
Without further ado, let's hop into our show.
Hey, welcome to the 207th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Seth Juergen, Kevin O'Brien, Camry Fox, and Glenn. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enloe. Today we've got Mickey Finnegan, an old pal and an incredible director, here on the show. He's going to talk to us about how he kind of struck music video gold straight out of the gate back when we were still in college. He's directed iconic videos for incredible, huge artists.
He directed shots for LMFAO.
Yeah.
Was like his second music.
Shots.
Yeah, he's worked with CeeLo Green, Miley Cyrus, Katy Perry, Lil Jon, Soulja Boy, Rebel Wilson, Tyga, Bella Thorne, Offspring, like everyone. He also does commercials and he's made shorts and we talk all about it. I do think one of the coolest things is that we both met him many years before we met each other.
Yeah, I would say that Mickey's probably the person we've had on the show where we have the most shared history between the three of us. You were working on his videos and kind of became a part of like that circle of friends, basically. I was always aware of him and like certainly we've all shot with each other's DPs for many years. So we've all been kind of like one degree away from each other for like, for 20 years, basically.
Did you know also that he has an Emmy?
No!
Yeah, 2018. So, I mean, it's kind of an expired Emmy by this point.
What did he win an Emmy for?
A Nickelodeon campaign of some sort.
Well done, Mickey. Really talented guy. And I think that besides some fun war stories, I think there's a lot of applicable, learnable lessons. Because he is a person who took some big swings early on and found some success, but then also continues to self-generate, like level up and figure out ways in which he can pivot and take his voice and find other ways to apply it to different mediums and different opportunities.
Yeah. And this episode, like many of our episodes, is a great example of how you can reach kind of the pinnacle of a certain segment of the film industry, but you still kind of have to like pitch yourself from ground zero in other segments. And we argue a lot about that in the episode.
Yeah, it's pretty great. So I can't wait to hop into that conversation with Mickey. But before we do that, Oren, what have you been working on lately?
Well, I've been working on a bunch of things, which I actually don't want to talk about because I think there are a couple other things I do want to talk about. Mm. One is the episode that just came out a few days ago had Michael Randa Parks on it, and we talked about his South by Southwest feature premiere.
Yeah.
Since we recorded that episode, South by Southwest has been canceled.
Been canceled, yeah.
And it's crazy, right?
I also have a shoot tomorrow, and one of the leads called in sick, basically. And I think that he's playing it safe. I think this person is
avoiding travel, avoiding airplanes, avoiding...
And not shooting, basically. He will not be in the commercial anymore.
He's just not shooting it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And again, I think that's because of an abundance of caution, and everyone appreciates that, and it's important for my personal well-being and also society. But like, you know, it's like a thing now, kind of on the verge of trying to figure out
what's happening next.
The country is going to approach this whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And not knowing like if we are just at the beginning and things are going to get way worse or they get better, or if things are going to get better. But it's a weird time. I was at Viacom today because they did this commercial thing with them last week and it was empty, and they basically sent an email to everyone saying like, if you want to work from home,
yeah,
it's totally fine with us. And you were saying that someone was saying that they experienced other people like stealing Purell from meetings and stuff.
So literally, this is for real, we all laughed about it, but the dude still did it. He had a like one of those little personal smaller Purells, and we're in the big conference meeting, you know, we had a big meeting, and there's the big jug is in the middle, and he took the jug and like went to town and just did like probably 10, 15 heavy squirts into his little jug, and then, you know, sealed it up and put it in his pocket. because it's sold out everywhere, basically.
Yeah. And I did do think this time, and I mean, I think our listeners worldwide will all connect with this. People are afraid to like get into big groups and gatherings. And mm-hmm. so this is the time to edit your stuff.
Yeah.
We can all work from home on our computers and do things.
I am also genuinely like, I'm trying to figure out ways to make like a mild quarantine sort of environment. Like what can you, how do you pass the time? How do you make use of it, but also make it fun? And I've like thought about multiple movies. Like I want to watch the entirety of a few different directors' catalogs, for instance, as a way
during the, if you are quarantined.
If I'm quarantined. Yeah, yeah. Or even if you're just trying to like, if everyone's laying low, if people aren't hosting events or throwing events or going out much, like what, how are ways to make a game out of it a little bit? So I've got a couple ready. I've got the Terry Malley Tally, which is where you watch every movies. Terrence Malick movie.
Okay.
Feig Fest.
Paul Feig.
Every Paul Feig. And then Apatowapalooza.
Wow.
And I think I'm going to do all of those.
Really long.
So part of it is also you have to think through, like, you want a manageable number of movies. Like, no one's going to be like, hey, let's watch every single Hitchcock movie. That's, like, right. It's freaking dumb. And for also, frankly, I think nearly impossible. Or every Woody Allen movie or something like that. You need, like, I'm talking no more than 10 movies in one oeuvre, right? Yeah. Terrence Malick, I think, has made 6 or 7. I own most of them. That does make me realize I have to watch Knight of Cups, which is a real stinker. I don't know if you saw that one.
I feel like you make the rules. You can say watch all but one.
Listen, the Terry Malley Tally.
Yeah.
You got to watch all of them in order.
Okay. Well, yeah. Sounds like a sport you would enjoy.
Yeah, it's the only one.
I really want to see The Invisible Man, but now I'm like afraid to go to a movie theater.
I know.
Should I be afraid?
I don't know.
Well, before we get into chatting with Mickey, I want to thank all our patrons. We really do appreciate it. If you want to be a patron, go to patreon.com/justshootitpod. You will be helping us a lot, and we just love it. And we've gotten some great patrons lately. And if you give us $10, you will get a Just Shoot It hat. Mailed some off today. Andrea Nelson, thank you for posting your selfie with a Just Shoot It hat. I mean, anyone else that has one, I recommend you post a selfie because I will make some obnoxious comment about it.
Yeah, guaranteed obnoxiousness.
I also want to apologize that we canceled our March 15th event that we talked about. You know, the world is just in a weird place right now. We just kind of felt like it was not the right time to have a big event where we shake everyone's hands. And lastly, just because we haven't talked about it for a long time, please, if you get a chance to leave us an iTunes review, it's really helpful. It helps people find the podcast, and it doesn't even have to be good. It just has to be a review. So if you get a chance, leave us an iTunes review. And we will be very appreciative of that. And now, without any further ado, let's chat with Mickey Finnegan. We're here with Mickey Finnegan.
Hey, hey.
One of the things we ask our guests is to send us a quick bio before the interview, even though we usually know most of it. But one of the things in your bio states that you're Asian American, that you're half Filipino. Why do you put that in your bio? Is it like, does it have to do with diversity?
I think that there's part of it that has to do in some level with diversity. I think part of it also has to do with the fact that, you know, even before sort of diversity was an issue, it was always sort of a thing in my identity that I felt was kind of important. And I've always been a little bit weirded out by like, my name is so, you know.
Close your eyes and you think of Mickey Finnegan, you think of like
Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, dude who's going to get sunburnt very quickly.
Right, right.
With like red hair.
I mean, there's so many times that I've had meetings where I've completely disappointed whatever people thought was going to show up. They're just like hoping I would come in like,
right, like with a rugby ball. Like
Mickey will train again.
Leprechaun or whatever.
Yeah, that's funny. That's funny because I didn't ever think of Mickey as sounding Irish. Or I didn't think about it at all, honestly.
Sure.
Yeah. But I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just something that, you know, I've just sort of added it because it was like, oh, hey, you know, it's something that I regularly tell people anyways about myself.
Yeah. I wonder if I should put that I'm Israeli. I mean, my name kind of gives it away in my bio, but your bio, you have Sacramento in there, right?
I don't think so. Yeah.
You don't?
I don't think so. I think it just says Los Angeles.
Because there is something nice about bios and just giving people like excuses to like talk, like give people things to talk about. It's like a resume.
Yeah. I think, you know, I feel like you guys have kind of talked about you know, branding and other episodes and things like that, and or even just like things to kind of humanize you to people who want to hire you or work with you or whatever. And it seems like that's kind of right in there.
I don't know the last time you read my bio, Oren, but I do make jokes about my parents all the time and like proving myself to them. And there is a joke like that in my parents.
Yeah. Which is, that's really funny because I don't know what your bio Oren is like, but do you guys have the bio where you're like, you have like tons of self-deprecating humor in it? Or do you say like, and I'm a dog owner and I love this? And, or is it like spoken in third person?
It's in third person, and it's like basically pretty quick, like brands I've worked with, shows I've worked on, USC, Los Angeles, and then closing joke about how my parents don't understand any of that, basically.
Yeah, it's not a lot of self-deprecation, but I do like throw away things like, in his spare time, he is like an award-winning VFX artist and has a podcast.
Right.
Was named one of one of filmmakers, Movie Maker Magazine's top 5 podcasts to listen to or something.
Right.
So I try to like, I'm saying that's this, you don't need to know this for me as a director, but just know I do other things on the side.
Well, speaking of bios and the laundry list of things, Miggy, you started mostly as a music video director. Hit us with the hits of your music video credentials.
Sure. Just like artists.
I can do it if that makes you feel better.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There you go.
Okay.
Well, I can name 2 of them.
Who stands out to?
Well, LMFAO, like you were, so both Matt and I have known you pretty much since college. You went to USC.
Yeah.
And I worked on some of your music videos. At the very least, Keek the Sneak's Super Hyphy music video.
My very first.
Which I saw. He just went to prison recently.
Oh, did he?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, like how recently did you see that?
Like in 2019. Like I was looking it up yesterday.
Oh, my goodness.
He got too hyphy.
Yeah. And so you know what that music video is about? It's about how Keek invented the word hyphy.
Right.
And he also claimed to have invented the term faux shizzle, my nizzle, right?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, certainly he claims to, you know, have invented the term hyphy, or maybe it was sort of like in the, at that time, like the Bay Area culture, like hip hop rap scene. Right. So I don't know if he was the, you know, first, but he certainly made the song that kind of,
I mean, the song is, the chorus is, that's my word.
Right.
Well, so when I had heard on set, and I wonder if it was from one of his people, though I doubt it, because they were mostly busy like drinking gin and juice and doing donuts in the parking lot.
Yeah.
While we were trying to separate, excuse my French, but the video hose from each other, because supposedly they would kill each other if they were in the same room.
Oh God.
one of them was very famous because she was in the Gold Digger music video.
That's right.
But, I had heard from someone that he had coined the term faux shizzle my nizzle, and he had taught it to E-40, like a more famous Bay Area rapper who was friends with Snoop Dogg, and he had said it to Snoop Dogg, and then Snoop Dogg made it famous. And so when hyphy came along, like Keek the Sneak wanted to make sure people knew that was his word, because his like awesome language was being stolen by other people.
I will say, because I remember that video was on heavy rotation in like college, like the closed circuit TV.
Right.
It was like a lot of like MTV2 videos. And I remember
being super hyphy ones.
Yeah,
one that I was a dolly grip on.
Yeah, yeah, it was a big deal.
Is my name on there? No, my name is in the credits.
Yeah, I think it probably.
Directed by Mickey Finnegan. Dolly gripped.
Well, music video credits. Very, very detailed.
Yeah. But then I was a camp counselor at the time, and I remember a kid saying hyphy in front of me, like a 7th grader or something, and I was like, "Oh, this is a big deal." It was a Northern California band music camp, but still.
Right.
And getting hyphy means getting high, right?
I think
I think it means getting hyper.
Yeah.
Right? It's like another way to say it.
But I mean, drugs are implied, right? Or not really.
It's
more like being like a hooligan, like running around clockwork.
If a 7th grader is saying that their friend is too hyphy, they're talking about candy, probably.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, I think to what you're getting at too is that whole Bay Area hip hop scene, you know, as it is coined, the hyphy movement, you know, was like encompassing with like sideshows and doing donuts and like you know, wild behavior like in the middle of the streets. So I think, you might be right to say that hyphy implies sort of that behavior as well. But I just don't know if the word itself.
Explicitly.
Okay. Yeah. Wait, and that was your first music video?
It was, yeah.
So let's unpack that a little bit, because... Because
then he was big, and we shot like on film, I'm pretty sure, right? On Super 16.
Yeah, we did shoot on film. Holy...
Man, we had a whole elementary Super school 16. That a buddy of ours, Oliver's, Vinny Singh's mom, like, hooked us up with.
Yeah, it wasn't Vinny's mom, but it was a friend of my... A friend of mine, his mom worked at the school, so that's how we.
And where was
it? Like, hold on, before because we're just strolling down memory lane. I'm gonna set the table a little bit, right? So we're still in college, right? Like, we're probably juniors, maybe, give or take.
We were actually seniors at this point.
Okay, great. Yeah. So, but getting serious, looking towards the future, how do we all get jobs? How do we have careers? Right? Music videos have not yet totally imploded. Mm-hmm. As we were saying off mic, you know, that's the era where like Spike Jonze has like made a couple movies at this point. We're all very like Adaptation is about to come out, or maybe has just come out. Fincher's already like made Fight Club and is already, you know, kind of like a hero of ours. So we had all realized that being music video directors could lead to bigger and better things. And also everyone is watching music videos.
Right.
Antville is like a big thing at the time. Like, you know, it's a fun time to be interested in music and abstract film and jokes and stuff all at once, right? And so, but still, shooting on film, actually, it's important to know, like, video looked like garbage.
Oh, God.
DSLRs weren't a thing yet, so it was, like, really hard to, like, if you wanted to have something that was broadcast quality, you had to have the money to expose and edit and then transfer film.
Right,
which is a lot of money.
Yeah.
You're not making a $500 music video on film.
Right. You literally couldn't do it.
Right.
So tell us how you managed to pull that off.
Sure. So like you said, we were, you know, seniors at USC, and it was getting close to graduation, and I was, you know, wanting to be a director, want to do narratives and things like that. And I was sort of asking myself, okay, what is my path going to be? You know, how am I going to get there?
And have you done anything at this point, like short films?
I mean, you know, the ones that you do in college and maybe the ones that you do, not for a class, but still in college.
Sure. So nothing good yet, basically.
Basically, yeah.
No disrespect, but like, you know.
No, everything I did in college was great, and all my work has gone downhill since then.
Sure.
But I actually, there was a cinematography class that you could take.
Got a little bit of film, right?
So I got some film in that, and actually,
but like 500 feet.
Not quite. This is a little more of a long, windy road to get to where you want to be. But like, I had this class, cinematography class, and you know, you kind of had a little thesis you did at the end of it. But I decided to do a music video, so I was very involved with like the sort of the dance team at USC, and I kind of knew a lot of the dancers in that the dance world that would then later on blow up to be like So You Think You Can Dance, like whatever that culture was, right?
You were just like friends with them, or you were dancing yourself? Like, how did you get into this group?
I was friends with them. It was like a group at USC, and you know, they would go to like these competitions, and the competitions are what inspired like Randy Jackson to create So You Think You Can Dance and America's Most Dance.
All these people just getting hyphy.
Yeah. So then, anyways, I decided to do a music video. I got the dance team to be in it, and that became like my music video reel.
And what song did you, like any song you wanted?
What did I pick? I mean, I picked like a known song at the time.
So you basically made a spec music video.
That's right. And to relate it back to your first question, you know, how I got involved in it. Like I deliberately did that because I knew that, you know, I was asking myself, what is my path going to be? I kind of knew some friends in the music industry that were talking about, oh, there's artists like E-40 and Keek the Sneak and this. So I knew that was kind of becoming, you know, hot and stuff. So I was like, okay, cool. Like maybe this could be my path. Maybe I can do music videos. Like I grew up watching them and I was a fan. I never had considered that would be the path. But like you said before, there's so much track record of people like Spike Jonze and stuff that have gone this route.
And hip hop was just like the genre you liked.
Yeah, I think that was just sort of the music I was mostly attracted to. And the directors working in that space, I was fans of.
When did, what was that dance documentary?
The one that was at Sundance? What was it? About crunking?
Oh, yes. Rise, I think
it was called?
Rise,
yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
It was by David LaChapelle.
Yeah.
David LaChapelle.
Yeah, because there were a lot of like hip hop artists, hip hop directors that were kind of making the transition right at that time as well.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and there's great, still great directors, even at that time, like Joseph Kahn and Dave Myers and people like that, you know, I really admired.
Yeah. Hype Williams.
Williams, you know. So we took the spec video and then when we graduated.
And what was the concept? Just perform it?
I got a bunch of dancers. It was just basically, there was no con. It was just glitz and glam, good dancing, you know.
What was the location?
I did a stage, so I had like, you know, a psych.
To have the camera stay on school grounds. I think it was part of the...
I think you're right, yeah.
Because I built a set for a similar project.
Okay.
And then we shot other stuff with a camera off school grounds.
Right.
Yeah.
With the video camera.
Yeah.
And did you shoot like off speed or do any of those things?
Yeah, I think I pulled out the tricks that I knew at the time, you know.
I think you maybe even had to. Right? Like you had to show certain techniques that you'd learned.
Yeah. I think probably, you know, and it was like, oh, like if I, you know, oh, if we turn the camera on and off while things like, oh my God, like during the, because you're shooting it on film.
We did that, I think, on Kink.
Yeah. Right? And it's like, oh, well, what does that do? You know, and it's just like,
wait, sorry, what does it do actually?
It just sort of gives this sort of fluttering, flashing effect.
Because the motor is slowing down and growing back, speeding back up. So, the exposure is a little longer, right?
Right. There might have been like even more nuance to it, and I can't quite remember, but yes, that was sort of the visual you got from it. So I, you know, we kind of thought that was cool and different, and we were trying to pull out, you know.
The thing that I remember always, like in the beginning of music videos, is like, oh, if we play the track, you know, twice as fast, and we film twice as fast, then we get this cool slow-mo, and the song is in sync with itself.
Right.
The first trick you do with music videos.
Right.
Okay, cool. Sorry. So keep going. So you made that video.
So we made it. And then we graduate. And, you know, I know of this music scene that's kind of becoming popular in the Bay Area. So I start to go out to like hip hop clubs and networking with the people I knew that were in the music industry and just sort of like introducing myself to artists. And this was like at the time when I think MySpace was... kind of the thing.
Sure. Yeah.
So
and you're saying I'm Mickey Finnegan. I'm a music video director.
Yeah. I'm going up to people and I'm like, hey, I'm a big fan of your music. I, you know, found it on MySpace or whatever it is. And
which it's important. The difference between MySpace and Facebook, people probably forget, like music was a big, big part of
that's
MySpace.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, bands are like the last people. I think they might still be on MySpace.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. But it definitely was the place to discover music at least at that time.
Sure. Yeah.
So I was meeting different artists and eventually I think I was maybe at an Amoeba Music or something and I met Keek the Sneak's manager at the time. And I certainly knew of his song and they, you know, this song is, you know, blowing up all over.
Super hyphy?
Yeah. Even beyond, you know, what is, you know, popular in the Bay. It's like starting to even be like when I'm in Los Angeles, I hear it. Mm-hmm. And I just go up to him and we start talking. I'm like, hey, you know, you guys don't have a music video for this. Like, would you want to do something like that? And so I introduced myself and I show my work and I sort of explained to him like, you know, why I think I'm qualified to do it. And
why do you think you're qualified to do it?
Because nobody else was doing it. Sure, right. You know, I mean, that was
keep
like
going actually. Cause I think, how did you finance the video?
Well, eventually it got to a point where we were talking about it and he was interested and for whatever reason he saw something in me or at least in the thing I showed him. And then we, you know, we kind of agreed like, hey, like this could be something good for me. It could be something good for you guys. What if we both co-finance it? Right. So you put in some money.
So that's a much easier yes.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
Like 50-50.
I think at the time it was like, he was going to put in $7,000 and then I was going to put in $3,000. So that was like, because I think that was $10,000 is kind of what we spent on that video.
Gotcha.
And so that was like effectively like me investing in myself, or that was my sort of thesis because, you know, we're crit studies majors, so we didn't spend any money on a thesis.
Shout out to critical studies.
Yeah.
To clarify, that just means it's like we had an English major, but we watched movies instead of reading.
Essentially, yeah.
Wow, I did not realize that was your first video. It's funny because on set, I was, you know, just like one of a crew person that didn't know you, and you seemed like a, you know, music video director to me. So, I mean, good. I don't remember anything you said.
Yeah.
I do remember that Keek showed up like, I don't know, 18,000 hours late.
Totally. Yeah. And the sad thing is
and like, we had to shoot all this stuff without him, without the main guy.
That's right. Yeah.
Like in the classrooms and stuff. And we had kids on set, like real children.
Right. I don't know what I was thinking pitching like this high concept, you know, spelling bee music video.
Yeah. Walk us through the concept real quick.
So the concept was, you know, I don't know if they still have them, but ESPN would do these like spelling bees that were like very intense competitions with kids.
Yeah, like all the Indian kids.
Yeah, basically would win them all.
And I think they're still a thing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you talked about the song earlier and it was like bringing this big importance on the word hyphy and like what it meant to the movement and to the culture and everything. So I don't know how I thought of it or whatever, but it was sort of like, okay, like a spelling bee, like let's bring emphasis to this word. And what if, you know, amongst these kids, Keek is the one of the spelling bee contestants and that's the word he gets and he wins. Like, so that was sort of like the, you know, idea surrounding it.
So it's almost like a short film intro, which was kind of popular at the time. I think it's kind of coming back now, but it went away for a while where you have like a preamble to the music video.
Right? Yeah.
Right.
Which was, I think was always my way of, you know, I always wanted to get into narrative. So let me like figure out a way to shoehorn some narrative elements.
So after that, you got some real hip hop cred. You do a couple other videos, right?
Yeah, I think I did a couple other, not many, like literally maybe like a couple other two.
And then you team up with this band that also no one had heard of at the time, right?
Well, if you're talking about,
like, they weren't mainstreamly popular.
No, like, are you talking about LMFAO or whatever? Yeah. It's like, I mean, I think that was maybe a couple years later. I'm kind of like, you know, trying to figure it out or whatever. And again, MySpace was really the ticket. I was constantly on MySpace looking at artists and bands and trying to figure out who was cool. And
how are you supporting yourself at this point?
I was actually doing many things. I was crewing on, you know, projects, you know, things kind of like what you were doing. And then eventually I actually did become an assistant to a director's rep.
Who repped
music videos.
Man.
And that was actually really good. Yeah. It was actually a really good experience for me.
So he was at a production company that knew people at labels and would pitch treatments on their songs.
Right. So, and at the time it was, you know, it was funny because it was sort of an interesting relationship where I had Super Hyphy and played for like whatever, 2 years on BET and MTV. But I was also like the assistant at this person's thing. And my videos were up against people that were, she was actually repping.
right.
But, you know, I mean, in fairness, it's like, I didn't really know what I was doing. I hit a home run with that, you know, and it's not like a sustainable formula, at least at that time.
Right. Well, you didn't write a treatment or anything like that. You just met a guy and like had a good idea and figured it out.
Maybe I wrote what could be called a treatment, but it was probably a blurb of words.
Couple paragraphs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You had to explain what your plan was to people, but it wasn't like you were pitching. It wasn't.
Yeah. And I actually got, I think eventually I got the good, almost the most ideal experience is that I was telling this to his manager, right? And I'm sure his manager was the one that was reading the things, but eventually I'm being reminded of this is I actually went to Keek's house at some point and got to pitch him in person this idea.
Yeah.
So that was actually like probably the first time he had even heard the idea.
Right.
And you know,
that's a much better way to
go. Yeah, totally. Like, it's the most
been getting it forwarded an email.
It's the most ideal way to do it. Yeah. Even today, you know, it would be the most ideal way to do.
Sure. And were you nervous?
Yeah, I think I was pretty nervous, but you know, maybe I was so naive at the time that like, I just didn't really, you know, I was just like, I think this idea is great. And I felt pretty good about it.
There's something magical about being in school and thinking that your shit doesn't stink.
Yeah, right? Totally.
Like you haven't been beaten down. You don't realize that you're about to be unemployed yet. So
right,
you're just like, oh, I've got a great idea. And people acknowledge how good ideas are.
Right. And I think, you know, I don't think that I had like a huge ego or anything like that. I'm not that type of person, but I think, you know, I just felt confident in my skills at that time, and I was too young to know what I didn't know.
Right.
Whereas
right,
like right. Now it's like, I'm confident, but like, I just know that there's so much more for me to learn
sure.
than whatever I thought at the time.
Right. So,
so you're on MySpace and you find LMFAO.
Yeah. I find LMFAO and,
did you do shots?
I did do shots. Yeah. I found them and, you know, was aware of their music. And then I eventually, I think I ran into him like in Hollywood, like in a club at one point. And I eventually walked up to him and I was like, hey, you know, I'm a music video director and I'm a big fan of your work, your music. And, you know, I'd love to like, you know, work with you or whatever. And I exchanged like contacts with him and didn't hear from him for like a year. But what I would do
this is the main guy. It's two guys, right?
Yeah, there's two guys in the group, and the main guy, Red Fu, is this guy. And I got his contact, his email, and I would just email him anything that I did, like my work. Like it's kind of like what you guys would do with, you know, sending just, to creative directors or agencies yeah. or whoever.
Just
you
like
work
a heads
with.
Up, like, hey, we did
yeah,
this.
Hey, yeah, hey, here's this new thing I did. Because I was still had some other music videos that I was doing. But I just knew I liked mm-hmm. whatever they were creating. Mm-hmm. And then literally a year went by or something like that. And I get an email or maybe it was a phone call from a video commissioner at Interscope. And they had been signed to Interscope. Mm-hmm. And they came out with a song called I'm in Miami, Bitch. Mm-hmm. And that was like their first big hit.
This is before Shots.
Yeah, this is before Shots. And so, and the label paired them with like, a very known director. Mm-hmm. And what I would later find out is that he had a very bad time working with that director. Mm-hmm. So anyways, flash forward and they're ready to do their next music video. And I get a email or a call from a video commissioner and said, that's her name is Nicole Ehrlich. And she's like, hey, you know, this artist gave me your contact and they say you want to work with you. And we got to go to Vegas next week to do this video Shots. And so I'm like, yeah, cool. Let's do it.
So no, you didn't even need to pitch on it. They just asked for you.
No, I did need to write a treatment, but sure. I was at least being asked as somebody who, hey, would you want to like
you weren't begging for the job. They were like respecting you. Like,
yeah,
I'd like to hear your idea on this.
I think so. Yeah. I think it was like, hey, you know, we want to do it.
That's pretty incredible though.
I mean, right? And yeah. I am. Yeah. Well, I guess to me, kind of like what I'm trying to hit on here, maybe I'm hitting it too hard on the head, is that like I am in Miami, Bitch. I think anyone that knows LMFAO knows that song. But before that song, no one knew them unless you were kind of like looking
sure.
for them.
Right.
Like,
tuned in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So no one knew that Shots was going to be a phenomenon.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. And I think,
or at least like a pop culture touchstone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think I remember feeling pretty disappointed actually was because I found them and I liked their music, at least I just thought they were kind of like goofy characters that were kind of fun.
Because right. I don't know anything about them, but weren't they kind of making fun of like the hip hop culture originally?
I don't know if they were making fun of it. I just think
like
that
they're
they,
like caricatures.
Yeah. I just think that at the time, I don't know how much credit or like, you know, the listeners want to give them for them being musical geniuses. I'll go to bat for him and say that I think the guys are very smart mm-hmm. and there is an element of genius to the stuff they were doing. They just kind of, they were guys that just, you know, wanted to have fun and
sure. bring party
people,
music.
Yeah. Bring yeah. people together and, you know, create it through party music, like you said. Yeah. So I think that, I just enjoyed whatever it is they were putting out. And when they eventually came out with the I'm in Miami Bitch video, cause I figured, oh, this song might get, you know, mm-hmm. popular. I was disappointed that I wasn't the one that he called because sure. I had been kind of
right.
emailing him,
like courting him.
Yeah, courting him.
Yeah.
So you
go to Vegas.
So I get Shots and I go to Vegas.
And what's the concept? Just like a party video?
What was the concept? The concept was
snap zooms.
I think. I mean, no matter what the concept was, it wasn't going to manifest mm-hmm. on our actual shoot day.
Right, right.
Because there was lots of alcohol involved. But I think-
Not on your side.
Not on my side. Although, you know, I certainly could have used a drink.
Like, were you nervous about this?
I was definitely really nervous going into it. because I thought this was for sure my first like real record label. Right.
Interscope. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Interscope Records. So
yeah, this is a distinct step up for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And so the concept, as I remember it, was something to the effect of, you know, it's a lame party, and then when these guys show up, like,
it's a good party. Yeah.
It's like, and
it's at a
whatever.
Pool. Is that right?
It's at a pool. It's at,
like in a hotel, right?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Towel.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's sort of like the idea was, whatever the minutiae of the idea was, the essence is that they're the life of the party.
Right.
So the very opening notes, they're not at the party yet.
Yeah. The very opening notes, they're not there. You know, no, it's a very empty pool. Mm-hmm. The DJ that's playing is super whack, you know, mm-hmm. and everyone is not having a good time. And then all of a sudden, you know, one of their groupies shows up and puts on the music, and Little John bursts in with like a bunch of, you know, party people, and they show up, and, you know, everything goes bananas.
And how do you get Little John? Do they pretty much get Little John?
Well, so they had Little John on the song. And he was a feature. And, well, you know, for me, Little John was like, this is like LMFAO is like the main band, but Little John is like, this is for sure a big artist that I'm working with.
Sure.
Like, at least for
me.
It's
yeah,
like,
definitely.
Oh my God. You know, I actually like know your music.
And can we ask like what kind of budget they were giving you at this point?
I think the budget was probably either like 25 grand or 30 grand.
No way. And that includes renting like the pool at Tao?
They got the Tao pool for free because I don't know what, you know, at the time, I think like the Tao group just like thought they were kind of cool. You know, they're kind of, you know, mm-hmm. a new group and they're
getting featured. Yeah.
And are there any safety considerations? Like all these drunk people at the pool with cameras, like electricity, gear, lights.
Well, here's what's really interesting is that the pool is open.
Right.
So.
You're just
running around.
The pool is open. So like, you know, and this is, you know, Tao Beach specific. If you guys like, you know the Vegas pool world.
Is that the topless beach?
It's not topless, but it's the one where when you go to a Vegas hotel, there's like the pool and everyone can go. And then there's like the club pool, which is like.
The one that has a DJ.
You got to, you know, put up some money or know people or whatever. And so we're filming in the, you know, in that part of their pool.
And sorry, just remind us, how old are you at this point? You're like 22, 23?
No. I mean, this is like, I'm 25, I think.
Okay.
So I mean, this is like 3 or 4 years since we've graduated.
Sure. Yeah. Still.
Yeah. No, it was an amazing opportunity for sure. So the pool is open and basically, I mean, we shoot in order, which kind of maybe added to the hilarity of the video when I go and watch it back, because it gets progressively more sloppy and falls apart totally, you know, like as everyone is getting more and more wasted.
Yeah. And they're actually drinking. Right?
100%.
Yeah. It's always boggling to me how much, because you always think like, oh, music videos, whatever. But like people do get messed up making music videos.
Yeah, that is really...
And it can be genuinely frustrating.
It actually is. It's like, you know, as I got into do more like quote unquote professional work or whatever, it definitely was something that like would always, you know, kind of be the antithesis of what we're trying to accomplish is it's like a sense of professionalism. And there's always people like, you know, smoking weed or partying or whatever. Yeah. And it just is a part of it.
Yeah.
Do you know how many views the video has on YouTube?
I don't.
247 million. Not cool. Bad.
Yeah. It's a lot of shots, people.
It's a lot of shots.
So how do you direct, like sometimes I'll watch a video like Shots. I think probably even at the time, I'm like, there's all these people dancing in the pool. Everyone's in bathing suits. Everyone's going insane. These people are jumping and spilling things on each other. How do you direct that? Are you yelling that out to them, or are you just like, have a good time and you happen to have really good performers?
Well, there's definitely an element of like, so there's a, what I would call like the master performance, you know, mm-hmm. you always get master performances or whatever in music videos, at least ones that are performance based. And in that particular instance, it's just, you know, coordinating a group of people mm-hmm. and saying like, okay, you know, we're going to hit the music and, you know, here's the camera move and this is what we're going to do. And we're going to run the song and, you know, everyone go crazy, you know, and then they're at that point like actors and they just do whatever they want to do right. at the time.
And are you dressing them and casting them and all that stuff?
There are people in that that were casted, because there at one point, right, was some semblance of story that totally fell apart. And they're supposed to be the people that, like, oh, you know, they weren't enjoying the party, and now they're here, and now they're enjoying the party. So, you know, some of those shots are like actors who mm-hmm. are, oh, I'm drinking now and having fun. But the large majority of people are people that were at the pool, and they're like, oh, this is like crazy. And they're already so, you know, messed up anyways that they're just enjoying the fact that sure. there's a music video being shot at their pool party.
Yeah. That's a story you tell forever.
Yeah.
So when you're shooting it, do you have a sense that it's going to work?
Let me put it this way. At lunch, I definitely went around the corner and had to hold back tears, because I definitely thought that the video, that this is like my big opportunity. Like this is, you know, I'm doing this label. Like I legitimately was like, I can't put anything together. Like I have no
there's
idea.
No story.
Like there's no story. Yeah. Like there's nothing.
Did John Penner shoot it?
No, Bobby Lamb shot it.
Oh, Bobby Lamb shot it. Yeah. Wow.
And I had to have a conversation with him, and like, you know, I think you could see on my face, like how worried I was and flustered. But eventually we just kind of tanked, like whatever our game plan was. Like after lunch, we said, okay, pull yourself up. And then you decide, okay, here's what we're going to do, and here's how we can salvage it. And it,
and you're shooting on 35.
What are we shooting on? You know, I actually don't remember. Maybe it was 16, or maybe it was 30. Maybe
but something knows? Where you can't be just rolling. Because nowadays, I feel like you're in that situation.
You just would shoot.
Just
nonstop.
Let's roll. Yeah. Just can you send B cam over there to get some inserts?
And I do
just
remember Bobby, before the video had come out, was like, "Yeah, I was in Vegas, and at a certain point, I was just snap zooming nonstop." I was like, "I don't know, man." Like,
yeah.
Just like, what do you do?
I mean, yeah, at that point I definitely, and this is funny, is that little John, as I would after the fact become, you know, like not friends with him, but like, you know,
sure.
cordial, and I ended wound
could ended you doing, text little John?
I could text little John.
Yeah, see, there you go.
I ended up doing a couple videos for him, you know, years down the road. But what he would tell me is like at the time he was like, this is he thought it was like a total disaster, like here's the thing, like he's a party guy and everything, but he's also a professional.
So
he, you know,
he knows what he's doing.
He's having a good time, but he's also like, he's been on sets mm-hmm. and he knows how it works, and he's sort of like, he legitimately thought like this was a total train wreck, but then when he saw it, he was like, this is genius.
So how did it turn around? What was the moment where you were like, oh, this actually will work?
I think there was just a time where it's like, let's just cover the song, mm-hmm. you know? And this is probably where Bobby remembers, oh, just snap zoom. We'll just get it. You know, just covering the song, capturing just the feel of what it's supposed to be anyways, mm-hmm. you know, not worrying so much about like, oh, I wanted to do my shot like this, and I wanted to get this vignette. It's sort of like, am I getting the essence of what, again, the concept
the
was
party, right,
yeah, which is so turning the party around, you know,
that's so brilliant, right? Like that's all you want out of, that's the distillation of certainly a song called Shots, right? But also like that group, do you know what I mean? Like bright colors, having fun, like getting the party going, and like there's something so, the getting out of your own way, maybe because you were forced to. Right, because people were loaded and like things are going crazy, but like that's the brilliance of it.
Yeah,
you know,
and it was a good lesson and something I wish, I think at that time I wish I was, you know, objective enough to sort of understand it. But it's something now, you know, I think one of the biggest things that has one of the ways I think I've matured most in my career is having that understanding of mm-hmm. I'm not so attached to very specific, like it has to be the shot or it has mm-hmm. to be this. I'm sort of more in, you know, attached to the idea of like, well, what is the core story I'm trying to tell? And, you know, letting my departments and mm-hmm. actors or whoever mm-hmm. just sort of serve it in their own way mm-hmm. and being okay with that.
Yeah. I mean, that's so smart. That's like a real, real gift to have that perspective.
Yeah. Wow. So, okay. So you have this LMFAO Shots video come out. It's obviously a huge hit. The song is a giant hit. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think people, that was years ago, right? And people are still playing the song.
2009 all the time. Or, you know, 2010, somewhere around then.
And so My just jogging my own memory, the next big video I remember from you, I could be wrong, but I think it was like a Katy Perry video with like Kenny G and Rebecca Black.
Hold on. That's very exciting to hear about. But I want to hear about, so you've got a hit video, mm-hmm. right? Does your life change?
No.
Yeah.
it does. I mean, look, it does and it doesn't. I mean, you definitely have now a piece on your reel that for the most part, you know, anyone who now will look at my work will say, oh, cool. Like, I know.
He did the shots video.
And at the very least, it's a conversation starter. And that's very helpful. But it's not like, oh, all of a sudden, you know, my phone won't stop and, mm-hmm. and everything like that. So there's still a lot of, you know, work that has end grinding, you know, and you get back from Vegas and it's sort of back to being one of 20 directors on the treatment, you know?
Sure. And also,
is that do literally 20 people sometimes pitch on a music video?
I don't know what it's like maybe right now, but I wouldn't be surprised if.
Wait, if the people are reading 20 treatments?
I don't know if they're reading it. I think
sure, that but the, they're so 20 directors are working their asses off on treatments and then getting whittled down to
probably
a
winner. Yeah. I think that there's
that is brutal.
I think that there were, you know, I don't know if it's their fault or whatever, but I think the video commissioners were shotgunning a lot of, hey, write a treatment, and then see what sticks, and then maybe they bring a few to the artist, and then the artist just wants to work with their friend anyway. So I think that that's kind of how it worked.
And I suspect there is no easy answer to this, but what's like, what do you think is like, what are your core things you want to include in a treatment on a music video?
For me, I think when it comes to a music video, the artist is like, they're not really going to read anything. I mean, I think that that's probably true of, even if you did commercials or whatever, most people aren't going to read it. Mm-hmm.
The text.
They're going to look at the pictures. But I guess the difference with, say, a creative director at a ad agency, I think that they're still concerned with what the core idea is. Whereas I think a lot of artists in the music video world are more concerned with maybe like a feeling or a tone. And I think that that's kind of the language that musicians speak, is they're thinking more in terms of like
less story and more like, what are people going to think when they look at
this? Yeah. Or just like, you know, I mean, I think for them, their music has a certain feeling that they associate with it. And I think that they might be looking for that in a treatment. The feeling that they're like, yeah, that's what I felt, or that's what I wanted it to feel like.
Right. And I guess I would assume some artists are more into storytelling and it probably comes out in their music, and other people are more into tone or feeling or visuals or they want to travel to a certain place and you're pitching that we shoot that music video in a certain place.
Yeah.
Or, and you were hung up on traveling to a certain place.
I feel like I mentioned it once, but I stole that idea from Tim Nakashi, who said it when he was on here, and he said that like, I found out this band wants to go to Japan, so I pitched something in Japan.
That's true.
So that's what you do. You kind of, you find the images that tell the tone.
Yeah, I think at least that was what I was going for. And again, it all depends on the treatment and who you're pitching to and how much of an idea is there versus it just being a performance thing. Mm-hmm.
So over the past 10 years, I mean, obviously music videos have kind of come down in budgets, and I know you do a lot more commercial stuff and TV stuff, but what would you say your batting average was on like how many treatments you wrote versus how many jobs you got?
I feel like I've written so many treatments, honestly.
Do you think you get like 1 out of 3 or 1 out of 10?
Oh, definitely more in the 1 out of 10 level.
And you think that's probably pretty normal?
I don't know, actually. I wonder, you know,
sure.
There might be people who bat way higher than that, but for me, that was probably my experience.
Yeah. Well, and I guess there's also the question of like, I think when you're starting out, those jobs maybe are more plentiful, but lower paying, right? Like mm-hmm. when you're in basically in between that Keep the Stink video and LMFAO, there were probably a lot of like, we've got $500 and we want to do a cool video. Mm-hmm. And like, those aren't quite as competitive maybe.
Yeah.
But then at a certain point, you know, when you're getting into the 5-figure, 6-figure sort of range for a project, like those are for keeps, you know?
That's true.
And so it becomes a little disheartening because you're not winning them quite as frequently.
Right.
Yeah.
So
to be a director, everyone.
Yeah. I mean, it's literally fighting the odds like every single day, like on everything you do. If you enjoy needing to be lucky, then you should be a director. Okay. So you made these music videos. You kind of, you worked with Lil Jon, you LMFAO, you know, you've done CeeLo Green now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kind of incremental steps of like bigger and bigger artists.
Yeah.
Maybe you're booking a little more consistently. Do you sign with reps at a certain point, or is it just kind of that your name is getting out there?
I did have a rep, I think, probably around the time when I did Shots. I can't remember what came first, you know, mm-hmm. it's somewhere all a blur in that time, but I had a rep and I did not have a production company that I worked with. So those jobs were going through production service companies or, mm-hmm. or whoever my rep sort of knew, like, mm-hmm. hey, I know this producer and they have a company and they'll run the job. But I'd say that the year, you know, around that time I started thinking, okay, like, you know, I would love to land on a music video production company or, mm-hmm. you know, ideally a production company that does both commercial and stuff, but sure, certainly for sure. me, like what was more attainable was one that specialized in videos. And there were a few out there at that time. And eventually I think I just sent my work around and I reached out to one company at the time, it was called Rock Hard Films. Mm-hmm. And, I took a meeting with the EP, who was also a director. Mm-hmm. It was a director-owned company and got on the roster.
Cool. And did you like it? How did things change for you once you were on a roster? Was it just still like, oh, I'm just treating the same way?
I mean, I'm assuming they're now sending you like tracks, right? And they're like, hey, listen to this. They're looking for a director.
Or are you still kind of kicking around on MySpace?
I think at that time I was definitely felt like I was still doing most of the legwork.
Yeah.
And my rep was the one sending me tracks or, mm-hmm. or at least, you know, putting me up for jobs. But, you know, most of the jobs that I think I ended up getting, ones for like, you know, Soulja Boy or Lil Jon or whoever, like they're all, or, you know, come from relationships. Like, mm-hmm. you know, Lil Jon's a good example of like, oh, you know, you do a video with him and then he knows mm-hmm. you and then he's a featured artist. And then right. when he needs one, like, you know, you have a much better chance.
Right. Right.
So I guess part of my idea to conduct this interview is based on Mickey, just you kind of reached out to me the other day and you said you'd heard about the podcast, but like I've known you for a long time, but it's not like we're really in touch, but I see you on social media. So
right.
there's these blips in my life over like the last 10, 15 years of seeing you. So I remember at some point I knew you were doing all these music videos, but then I see this short film you put out with John Petter, a DP that I met through you, but I also had worked with, and it was this esports short film and the production value looked like crazy high. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that? Like, why are you making a short film now that you have a music video career off the ground?
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is, you know, some years later. And I think for me, like my goal, of course, was always like, oh, you know, I'm going to go on the Spike Jonze path. I'm going to do music sure. videos and then commercials and narratives and things like that. And everything was going well. But I had realized like, hey, you know, I think at a certain point, I'm like, hey, I'm kind of like not mm-hmm. like, taking the turn that I want or putting in the effort of like going to where I want to go. Mm-hmm. And that's to do narrative work. So for me, it was like, okay, I should do a short or I should, you know, start to develop things that I want to direct or, you know, just put more effort into that lane. Mm-hmm. And aside from videos, like a big passion of mine was always, gaming and video games and that whole culture. And at that time I was, you know, particularly interested in esports. I mean, I'm still interested in esports, but it was becoming.
What are your games? League of Legends.
League of Legends.
Yeah, yeah. Anything else?
No. That's it. That's it. That's it. I mean, I wish I had like more time to play more games.
You focus.
But that's the one game that, you know, I can dig into every now and again. But I wanted to do a short and I would watch, you know, some of the docu content that was coming out about some of these esports players, and I was
Vice did a lot of great
sure.
stuff.
Yeah. Also, we had a friend who was like making a ton of that stuff as well, and was in house at one of those. Big companies.
And so I was, you know, consuming this content, this docu content, following these player stories as I paid attention to the esports, and I was really inspired by like, you know, the things that they were going through, and thought that it was, you know, for them, it was a high risk dream like any other, where they were going to give up everything to sort of, you know, pursue this career in esports, and also, you know, much to the chagrin of their families, and certainly, especially some year, you know, 5 years ago, the idea of being a professional gamer is ridiculous.
Sure. Yeah. Right. When we were children, it was like a pie in the sky dream. Like, right. What if I made money playing video games?
Right.
So did you picture it as like a drama?
I did picture it as a drama. I think because of the stuff I was seeing and understanding their stories and being, you know, inspired by them, I think that felt like the most sort of natural to do something in the coming of age space about mm-hmm. that. So I got, you know, decided to write a short film about it and do it.
And then, and what came of that?
So I did the short film, and I think at the time, I wish I was listening to the Just Shoot It podcast at the time.
Because I don't think it existed yet.
It may have not. When did you guys start?
I mean, maybe actually.
It's been almost 5 years,
yeah,
right?
About 5 years.
2015.
Okay. So, yeah. So 2015, 16 is when I did sure. this.
We probably weren't releasing regularly yet.
Gotcha. But I really didn't know anything about, you know, mm-hmm. the sort of festival world or what mm-hmm. to do with your short or, you know, what becomes of it.
I think it's so interesting because, like, I think people listen, like, he's done all these giant, you know, music videos, like, he's, like, legit stars.
Yeah.
And he went to film school, but then he's, like, it's interesting how segmented all these different things are, like, music videos and commercials and shorts and
yeah.
features.
Yeah, and it also, I mean, something I think you guys do a good job talking about on the podcast, it's like, you know, I know you, Matt. You
sure.
know, it's like, yeah. you know, we don't see each other all the time, but I probably could have just texted you or emailed you and said, hey, you know, would you want to get coffee and just
sure.
help me, you know, guide yeah, me. Yeah. I'm doing my first short. Like, it'd be great to just pick your brain. Cause I certainly knew that you have done stuff and
right.
like all the way back to Mountain Man and
sure.
been in, yeah, these, yeah. in these things. So it would have been smart of me to sort of.
Right. Well, and it's hard to know to do that stuff.
Yeah.
Certainly. Yeah. Yeah. yeah it feels, cause I don't think that. Like, certainly my parents never, like, had, like, a business question where they would, like, call a pal and then, like, go to coffee over. You know what
right.
I mean? It's not learned behavior. Like, you have to kind of, I feel like I picked it up in the development world.
Mm.
The development, because it's so meeting-based.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, we're going to go, like, talk to somebody about this project and that project. That's, you know, that cliche of, like, let's do lunch. That's real, you know?
Right, right.
But applying it to just, like, asking a peer what to do next, I think, is an easy thing to underestimate.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so for me, I think I completed it and then wasn't sure if it was something, hey, should I just put it online and, you know, maybe people enjoy it, or should I put it in festivals? I wasn't really sure and certainly didn't know any strategy to
sure.
like, you know, what does this type of film belongs in what type of festival, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I did submit it to certain festivals and
did you finance it yourself?
I did finance it. Yeah.
Can I ask how much you spent on it?
I spent, $20,000.
Wow.
On it.
Yeah. So you were like all in, you're like, this short is going to help me move my music video career into, or help me move my career as a director into narrative stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I at that point I had an agent and a manager and stuff, and
sure.
I had been, you know, going into meetings and getting into circles and pitching on maybe features mm-hmm. and stuff. But, you know, I'm still a music video director. It's still sort of hard
right.
for me to really, you know, land a job in
yeah,
that way.
That's interesting, because a lot of people, and I feel like I got this advice a lot when I was kind of like at that place in my career where people are like, don't use your own money, like get other people to pay for stuff.
Mm.
Like go pitch on things and go do this thing and convince other people to pay for stuff. But then you see the people that are actually successful at doing it and they don't mm-hmm. do that. They make their yeah. own thing so that they can control it and mm. they can show people this is
exactly
what I would make.
Well, that's yeah. interesting, because it did remind me, at the time I did meet someone at Disney who, I forget what department she worked in, but they were doing this program about, you know, funding short films, and mm-hmm. they actually, you know, I pitched her Godlike and she said, oh, we'll fund it for you. But I actually chose not to do that because they were going to like sort of release it mm-hmm. on whatever their channel was or whatever.
Sure.
And so I wasn't sure if that was like a smart thing for me to do.
Right. Then they'd own it, all of that stuff.
And I was maybe thinking, oh, maybe I can try festivals and things. And I kind of wanted that experience. And luckily I was an opportunity where I could fund it for myself.
Sure.
And was there an idea that it could be a feature or a TV show or something at that time?
Yeah, I think I certainly thought, okay, yeah, this could be something that is, you know, turned into a feature or perhaps a streaming series or something, whatever makes sense for, I guess, that demographic of who would want to watch it.
Sure. Yeah, $20,000 is a funny number, right? Because it's so much if it's coming out of your own pocket.
Yeah.
And not a ton if you're making a short,
right?
You know? And also, if you compare that number to, say, the theses that we were all working on in film school, you know, like a fraction sometimes.
Right.
You know?
And it was interesting because when I did it, you know, it's also, and this is probably true for you guys too, but I'd love to hear you talk about it. It's like, you know, you guys work regularly and you, your work is at a certain level. Mm-hmm. So is it, you know, it was going to be hard. I mean, $20,000 is still really nothing, but like, it still was going to be hard for me to direct something in a way where I had the tools that I felt I needed to tell the story properly.
Yeah. There's a gift in like when you start out, like I did 3 web series, like all the way through without a monitor. You know what I mean? Like
you're just standing next to the camera.
Operator. Yeah. I would just look over the DP's shoulder and then like focus on the performances like for years, you know, for probably 5 years. And liked it. And now, you know, it's hard to turn away from being able to look at the frame, for instance. Just as a metaphor for like, you know, once you start to level up, it becomes harder and harder to, you know, ignore the creature comforts or sometimes the necessity of those things. Like, you know, like there's a lot of things that are stylistically are informed by just the lack of gear. You know, there's no like rack focus in Squaresville because we couldn't pull focus.
Right.
You know, like,
all the blocking is everyone is standing on the same flat plane because the lens was broken.
All of the blocking is quite stationary because we couldn't follow people around. You know, it's like a lot of kids like talking on beds or in tree houses or whatever. Right. And like, I didn't realize how limited I was because we kind of made it work. And also because I think I was fortunate enough to have people who were skilled technicians who could kind of hide those flaws from me rather than someone just being like, well, if you had fucking rented a follow focus and a real camera, we'd be able to make them walk into the scene stupid.
Right. But you know? Mickey's point, you weren't coming off $250,000
shoot
the day before.
And so, I think there is that thing of figuring out how to come to terms with that or make those decisions for yourself. Yeah. You know,
well, so where do you
all of it, just to say $20,000 again, so much friggin' money.
And to spend,
but
not a lot to have.
But compared to what you're normally using, right?
Yeah. So on $20,000, do you pay your crew?
I think I did pay my crew. Yeah.
And do you get permit?
Yeah. The money was used in a way that was like, okay, I don't have to worry about getting kicked out of this location.
Right.
But you know, it's not all like sunshine and rainbows. You know, while I'm filming, it's still like, you know, run and gun, and maybe there are scenes in that film that we still stole, but like for the most part in the main locations we're able to.
Let me ask you, if you had done it where everyone was working for free and you did it the wrong way, right, like you didn't get permits and like maybe you shot on a DSLR or something like that, how much would it have cost you?
I think a lot less. I think that I mean,
like
5,000. Yeah.
5,000, probably. Yeah. Yeah. So like there's that weird thing of like, you know, thing that there's the arms race, right? I'm living through that with the feature that we just did where it's like, well, yeah, I have to permit because of course I can't risk getting kicked out of a location that I'm embedded in for a week or something
right. Right.
And then your insurance is probably requiring. It's like there's that weird little incremental step that if you can keep it low enough, then you're okay. But yeah, I think as we get older, we're just not used to even seeing how to cut those corners anymore.
Yeah. But there is something kind of interesting about music videos too, because like If you had $20,000, if I had $20,000 and I wanted to go shoot a scene at the Tao Beach Club,
right?
There's no way I could do it, right?
Right.
But then for $25,000, you can have a giant music video, big party there.
With how many extras, quote unquote extras,
right?
Probably,
right. Like 100. Hundreds or, or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting how the budget number really has little to do with.
It is interesting when you phrase it, it's like, depending on what the context of the job is, it's your money can go longer or shorter, mm-hmm. just depending on what, you know, how everyone understands what you're doing. You know, I think with a music video, it's like, it's harder because, you know, nobody wants to put in favors for a music video. Mm-hmm. Whereas like a short film, you can kind of get favors from sure. friends and things yeah, like yeah. that because people understand.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And maybe there's a little bit more, I think, similarly, like there are people who want to move into narrative, you know, like yeah. narrative is always the thing that people want more of. So it's yeah. easier to find like a DP who will volunteer their time, or like, you know, people who can kind of upgrade, people who want to like do more script supervision or whatever, the even like the different jobs that you tend to need to pay more. You can even give them, you know, a smaller rate or something like that.
Right.
And they're excited about it because it means opportunity in different ways.
Right.
So let me ask you something that people will know why I'm asking you. Like, which job of yours got you into the DGA?
Definitely not the coolest job I've ever done. It was a promo for Mike and Molly.
Uh-huh.
It was just kind of a random thing. It was like a promo for Mike and Molly. There was a company that had hired me a few times to direct things for like television promos and some mm-hmm. commercial work. And
all this, non-union.
Yeah, at that time, or for whatever it was all non-union. And then when this Mike and Molly thing came around, it had to be DGA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know how it works for them or why, what jobs they decide to do DGA.
And they didn't want to just bring in DGA director?
They had someone doing one part. It was like, there were multiple promos, and I don't know why they decided to do it, but one guy was doing one and then I had another.
Mm-hmm.
It just had to do with the fact that, I mean, we literally shot them at the same time and they rotated the actors, I guess.
Oh, crazy.
I don't know. It was, huh. Maybe right. it was akin like to like a TV show. Yeah. Like how they have to sort of juggle whatever. Mm-hmm. So they needed someone who could come on, and the guy that was doing one of the promos was in the DGA. And they knew me, and they kind of threw my name out to, you know, the company and the network and stuff. And they said that, you know, if Mickey can get sponsored by, I think you have to get sponsored by three people in the DJ, or basically do the work, mm-hmm. before the shoot, then, you know, he can do the job and then I can join the DJ. So,
and now that you're,
yeah,
there you go. I mean, it kind of is, right? Like that, it's just kind of like,
yeah, when the right job comes up. You just have to get a DGA job.
Yeah.
Are you guys DGA?
No,
we're not, but it's something that I feel like, well, basically every production company I work with now is like, I'm like, I would very much like to be in the DGA. And they're like, we do not want you to be in the DGA.
Mm.
So
it's so interesting because I would think you guys would be, because you guys sure. do a lot of, well, I mean, you know, even in commercial and stuff, or like you guys have done a lot of great narrative stuff too. So
yeah,
I just would think over some circumstance you would have.
I think it's very close. I'm in a position now where commercially the company that I'm with is not DGA yet, but I think that's just circumstances of like it being very new and very soon they will be.
Right.
And so like, I would be surprised if I don't join this year.
Gotcha.
But I'm also nervous about it because, you know, we talked to Josh Rubin and, you know, I do want to do like a indie feature in the future. And like when you go really micro budget, it can get complicated because you still have to have a first and a second. And, you know, like there's some things that are designed to protect directors, but when you are also the producer,
right,
maybe you're forced into a decision, basically.
Right.
That makes me a little nervous. And then also it's a lot of money. And also we have plenty of friends who like got edged out of non-union work because they joined a little too early and didn't quite have the connections to get that, rebuild that work just quite yet.
Right.
You know? And so like, to me, it's about tearing the Band-Aid off. And so I think we're both probably pretty ready.
Yeah, I mean, I have a totally different perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think? Yeah, yeah.
I don't know of any people that are not getting jobs because they're DGA. Maybe like once or twice. Like I got one job that I know of over like that Jeep spot of over the years. I know of one job I got because I was not non-union. I know of many more jobs that I did not get because I was not union.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I know, you know, like anytime, yeah, it's a signatory company, more in the narrative space. On the commercial space, I have yet in the last 3 years to work for a company that does not have both a signatory side and a non-signatory side. Mm-hmm. The right. Biscuit has yeah. gravy. There's I'm blanking on all the names of these production sure. companies.
But you're totally right, though.
They're all quite
but
clever
like the company
too.
I work yeah, yeah. with, yeah, like I've worked the... I'll let this, I mean, I don't even want to say it actually, because a lot of times it's like, oh, they flipped us. So we're got to use this other company name.
Yeah, you're yeah.
like, what? Who's paying me?
Yeah.
Why is this hardware store paying? Yeah, they're yeah. like, that's our union. So
yeah. yeah.
I think the reason people don't want me to go union is because then the budget doesn't work anymore.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, but I mean, I don't know if this is like a bad thing to say, but I feel like it's kind of in that space though, where, you know, to equate it to people who are actors you might know that are in SAG, and they might still sort of just do non-SAG work.
But, right, like a Funnier Die like, video or
no
something.
No one's going to really sure. come after them or whatever.
Well, that's what I
Which is not
think.
Entirely true. No, I know a director who obviously I wouldn't name who got a real
Matt
wrist
Pollack?
Slap.
Tim Kemp? Mickey Finnegan?
Yeah, no, just to look through all of the people who've ever been on our show. But yeah, no, like got in trouble for it. I can think of two people who got in, three. Who got in real trouble for
Interesting.
It.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm doing a promo for American Idol.
Oh, cool.
On ABC this month, but they never, I don't think
well,
they
I've,
care.
I've, yeah.
But I'm
curious. DGA. Yeah.
I've also done a promo for
ABC.
ABC. But they don't do their promos union.
Well, they hired a third party company, but yeah. then we're using like, their crew, which is weird.
That is weird.
Can we talk a little bit about promos, actually? Because
sure.
it is a...
Is that kind of your bread and butter now? I know you do a lot of commercials, too, but if you, I look at your site, there's a ton of promos.
Yeah. I mean, it's so weird. Like, for me, it's like, I'm just like in the place where, you know, what's the next job? Like, one mm-hmm. leads to the next. And then, you know, from some of my video work, I got asked to do a promo. And I was like, cool, yeah, whatever. And so... I ended up having a lot of promos for whatever reason, just meeting people over.
And can we just define a promo yeah. for yeah. our listeners that don't know?
I guess a promo is could be a commercial for the network, or could be something that a network is, you know, doing a commercial for a TV show they have, or mm-hmm. maybe there's an award show like the Oscars, you know, mm-hmm. and they need to promote that, and that would be a promo. And these are things, commercials that are for, you know, networks
mm-hmm. for TV shows
for,
and networks
yeah,
for
yeah,
whoever's
yeah.
airing it,
which is different than a commercial, which is like always for a brand basically.
Yeah.
But so it is its own ecosystem.
Yeah.
And we had Ira Rosenzweig on, who does a decent amount of promo work as well. But it's a thing that I've done a couple, but it's a world that I'm not super familiar with, frankly. Yeah. yeah.
I mean, I've done a handful, but I'm really not familiar with it either. Like,
yeah.
you know,
I'm ready. Let's do it.
yeah.
But yeah.
But they're cool, right? Like you did Scream Queens. You
yeah.
did,
yeah. I mean, some
Scream,
of them.
That's the breakout one for you, right? Like Scream yeah. Queens was the one where it was like, oh, it makes sense to get someone who has style to yeah. do something.
Yeah. And it was, you know, when I got the call for that, that was how it was sort of presented. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, we want someone who can do like comedy, but kind of like pop and keep mm-hmm. it sort of colorful. And
but do you write a treatment for that or no?
In that particular one, I didn't have a treatment that is anything to the level of what
like a commercial
we would do
treatment.
For a commercial or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I did kind of create like just maybe it's just for me and the network creative. Like, hey, here's like 2 pages or 3 pages of like this is what we're going for.
Sounds awesome.
It was awesome.
And was it your idea or was it their idea that you built on?
It was his idea. It was very much like a commercial. Like here are the concepts and you know, what, you know, thinking, you know, how can you put your spin on it?
Mm-hmm.
But that show was kind of interesting too, because at that time when I did the promo, they hadn't filmed the show yet.
Mm.
So Ryan Murphy, who created the show and created Glee and all these other things, was somewhat involved in it. And mm-hmm. so I had some correspondence with him.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So does promo work ever lead to directing a TV episode?
In my experience, it has not led to that.
Because you're working with the actors from the show.
Yeah.
You're making something that has is tonally similar to the show.
Yeah. But maybe I can check back with you guys on that, because I've applied this year. I applied to a couple television directing programs.
Awesome.
And in some of my letters of recommendation that were required for that, like, I referenced the fact, like, hey, I had this taste of like directing, you know, a network show and actors, and like being able to kind of navigate, like, oh, putting your voice on it, but also you can't tell them what to do because they know their characters better. And,
you know,
just being able to sort of navigate that.
Fascinating. Yeah. I am apprehensive about that part of it, because my attitude has always been that once you are introduced to an entity or a person, they think of you as the job that you are currently doing.
Sure. Yeah.
And so it's really, really hard to break out. You have to build a real personal relationship with someone for them to understand that you can do something besides the thing that you were initially hired to do.
Yeah.
You know? And so, like, in a certain sense, I'd rather not get to know the showrunner if I was shooting promos for a show that I actually wanted to direct it. Well, to direct. And hope that they didn't recognize my name, you know?
I mean, they
unless they love the promos, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it is a different skill. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, making a television show...
Right, but being good at promos does not mean you're not good. You don't have the skills of the TV.
Sure.
It means you have some of the skills. And so it's like, if you're interviewing for a job and they want to know, is this person good with actors? Is their aesthetic taste person? Are they good with crews? Can they deliver on time? And then can they tell a story over half an hour? So the promo isn't giving you, like, maybe potentially the most important part of it, but it's giving you, covering you on all those other fronts, right?
Right. Yeah. I'm not saying that it's logical. I'm saying that I have observed that pretty consistently and also caught myself doing it. You know, I can think of, like, plenty of people who were great crew members who have explicitly said, like, hey, I want to do something different. And I have to really remind myself when I'm looking for someone to do that job that, like, oh, the person who, you know, was pulling focus really is a great DP or something like that, you know?
No, I think you're right in some sense of, like, it probably, you know, I don't think if I was, like, you know, the promo guy who, like, did, you know, hundreds of them, that would be an obvious, like, hey, like, I should get Mickey to direct my TV show. Like, but I also don't think that a showrunner really, you don't interface with them that much, and they wouldn't remember that you did it. And
that's true.
You know, I don't think that you doing a promo for one show would mean that you'll never be able to do that.
You are absolutely right. That's true. Yeah. It does make me think of Joseph Kahn did a couple episodes of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Mm. So Joseph Kahn he was a huge music video director and then made a movie or two. He made Torque, which people, I think, wrote off, but it's kind of meant to be sort of, it read as like Fast and Furious.
Meant to be bad?
I think it was meant to be sort of funny. Yeah, maybe a little tongue-in-cheek. And
he did.
It's definitely a movie that seems like you're in director jail now.
Yeah.
Like,
well, he made another feature, right?
Maybe.
He made a movie called Bodied, but he did another.
He was the music video guy and then made a couple of movies.
He also made that Power Rangers short.
Then went back to music videos, but it was still like, okay, like how do I dig myself out of this hole?
Funny side, quick Joseph Kahn story, because I've always thought he was really amazing and I've always admired his work. He did do a movie, I can't remember the name of it, but it had a very small showing in a Burbank theater, and I went
because
I wanted to watch this movie.
Sure.
And it was me and my girlfriend
and Joseph Kahn
and like and two girls actually, and we were like the five people in the theater.
That's so good.
But then after the show, I introduced myself and talked to him and told him great job and all that stuff. Yeah.
Can you tell him about the podcast?
I don't know.
I also worked with him. You know, my only job I got fired on was the Jamiroquai music video. I was a PA on. My roommate was his assistant.
But not not the Jamiroquai video.
Not the not one, not virtual the Virtual Insanity. Virtual Insanity. It was one we shot on the Fox lot. I forget what the song was.
What did you do to get fired?
I was a PA. I was supposed to like return all the wardrobe that we didn't wear to Universal by 5 p.m. And it was like raining and I didn't know that it was by 5 p.m. But they sent me at 3 p.m. from the Fox lot on mm-hmm. Motor. And it was like literally the worst traffic of L.A. in my entire life. I mean, this is like 15 years ago or something. I got to Universal at like 5:05 and it was closed. And I called the wardrobe people. I was like, hey, it's closed. What should I do? And they're like, what? You just got there? I was like, yeah, it was like insane traffic. And this is like pre-GPS days or anything. And they're like, why didn't you call us? I was like, I don't know. I didn't know it was going to close at 5. They're like, you didn't know it was going to close at 5. Why didn't you call it? I'm like, why would I call you? And they're like, okay, well, go to Warner Brothers. See if they're open, because I was supposed to go there afterwards. I went there. They were closed too. It's like, yeah, they're also closed. They're like, you've ruined everything. It's going to be thousands of dollars extra. Oh, we're supposed to return everything today. And I came, literally as I came back, my roommate was the loader on the set. And she's like, even by the time I got there, she's like, Orin, you got to go apologize to the producers. Like, everyone's pissed off at you. And I apologized to the producers and everything. And then like I woke up at like, they needed someone to take the film to Technicolor or whatever to like to take mm-hmm. it that night. They're like, well, we were going to ask Orin, but now we can't trust him with anything. They literally, like all the producers were saying this. And the production coordinator and the manager. And
that's so good.
And then the next morning I like went like 4 a.m. Like, right. I was waiting for them to open. And I was like, can you please take these clothes back? Like, please don't penalize them. It's my fault. I was supposed to come yesterday. Yeah. And they're like, oh, these are on like a week rental. There's no penalty. No, it's like no big deal at all. And then I went to then basically they like didn't want me to come back. And then I got a call like later that day. They're like, hey, can you recommend a PA for this shoot? Like they asked me to recommend someone to replace me.
To replace?
Yeah.
That's insane.
And I was like, no.
People are so mean to PAs.
This was 2005 or something. Yeah. I mean, right. People were mean to that's, very mean to PAs at that time.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, true,
and I was like, the, you know, I was getting $80 right to be on set from like 4 a.m. to like God knows what time to like 6 a.m.
Right, yeah. Right.
Like 26 hours. I mean, it was just insane.
Have I ever told I didn't get fired because they weren't paying me? But I have a similar, I actually really did mess up on this one. So it was fair that they, I don't know if I've ever told this show on this on the podcast. So I was an intern at the Directors Bureau, which is a music video company. And at the time, Mike Mills, who is still a significant idol of mine, was making his first feature.
By the way, he's gonna be asked to be on the show. I'll see if he doesn't.
I'll retell the story then. I literally, like, he would be in the office or whatever. I'd, like, watch his dog, and I couldn't string a sentence together in front of him. Like, I just, like... still like a big deal for me in terms of filmmakers and a person who had done the thing of like was transitioning out of music videos and into features. Anyway, so he's got this movie called Thumbsucker. This is before Beginners and all of his other movies. And they were doing pickups. And like I had been there for kind of a long time, but this was like the first real big set that they had going. And so they were like, Matt, will you come PA? And I was like, yes. And they were like, you can pick up Tilda Swinton for this pickup day.
Wow. Big responsibility.
I was so excited. And like I had, you know, I was rehearsing banter in my head.
Right. It's like a date.
Like I had like stuff to talk about. I had like deep cut like film school references because she's like in a movie called Blue, that's a Derek Jarman movie where she's a voice, but it's like the director has basically gone blind, so the movie is literally just Blue, and I had just seen it on film and had all these questions. I was ready. And at the same time, my roommates had we had all chipped in. This is real film nerd stuff. We'd all chipped in on a region-free DVD player and got Infernal Affairs, which is the movie that The Departed is based on, and they watched it that night, and they were so friggin' loud and so excited to like decode like what was happening and all the twists and turns and stuff that I didn't get to sleep. Mm. I didn't fall asleep until like basically I should have been picking Tilda Swinton up. And so I wake up and I realize and I run to my car and I call the second AD and they were like, yeah, Tilda's outside waiting. I'll go pick her up myself. And then the rest of the day, everyone knew that I just left children outside. Yeah, like that's a pretty big mess up.
Oh my god.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, like, the people from the Directors Bureau didn't realize it till a little bit later. So they were like, hey, how's Matt doing? And I was, like, just busting my ass. I was just, like, trying so hard, mm-hmm. like, sprinting everywhere, like, doing. And they were like, I could tell there was a moment where they were real proud of me and then not anymore.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. That's a pretty big ball to drop.
Yeah.
Pretty big tilde to swint.
Yeah.
probably wrap up soon, but can you, what's going on now? So you're doing a lot of commercials. Pitching on commercials.
You know, pitching on commercials is on the grind. Writing two features that I have that I'm excited about.
And, that's exciting.
Yeah. And, you know, directing whatever's next.
And are you rep? You have TV and film reps?
Yeah, I have TV and film reps, but, you know,
you feel constantly like disappointed by them and disappointing them at the same
time. Well, it's just like, you know, it's, I don't know what your experience is and we won't go too long, but the idea of it being like, you know, they're at big agencies and stuff like that. So I'm very low on the totem pole for them. So understandably, it's like, I'm not a priority.
Are you vying for like there's a few shows that are probably like a little more music video director friendly. Like Dave on FX right now.
Zoe's Infinite Playlist.
That's a great idea. Yeah. Like, are you kind of like trying to make those happen or is it just kind of like, you just get your own stuff
I think it's get my own sort of stuff going. Make sure that I'm creating narratives that are in line to, you know, what I think my voice is. And
isn't it so crazy how now, like, the longer you're a director, the more, I don't mean this as a negative thing, but the more unsure you are of what your voice is, you know?
Oh,
like when you're pitching your very first music video at Keek the Sneak's house, you're like, this is what it's going to be. Yeah. It's a spelling bee. And I saw ESPN and I saw this and this makes sense. Yeah. And you're like, perfect. I'm the guy to do it. And then now you're like, then all this stuff, like, I think this is what I, like a drama, but more like a thriller kind of, like a dark drama, like in with digital element, you know, Black Mirror, like you're just like mumbling around like who you think you are.
Yeah. And that's when you just have to ask people like, what do you think my work is like?
And sure.
They'll have a good answer for you.
That's what all of the coffees I take are. I'm just like, tell me what I am.
What are they, what
are you
say?
My mother?
Like you are paying for this coffee.
You are a coffee snob.
Well, cool. Well, do you mind sticking around for an unpaid endorsement?
Sure, yeah.
Unpaid endorsements.
So I guess my unpaid endorsement is for a graphic novel that I'm reading right now.
Ooh.
That I really am enjoying. It's by Ed Brubaker.
Sure, yeah.
If you know him, he's a really great writer. And it's called The Fade Out. It's something that it's a few years old. I'm definitely late to the party here.
It's like a screenwriter sort of thing?
It is.
Right?
It's about a screenwriter in the 40s, you know, during sort of like the Blacklist era, but it kind of just has that real pulpy, old fashioned, Hollywood murder mystery and, a big star gets, you know, killed and he's got to kind of investigate and then weird stuff happens after that. But it's a really, really well done, and Ed Brubaker is a tremendous writer, and I highly recommend it.
Awesome. It's been a while since we've had a comic as an endorsement, and I am stoked on that. My unpaid endorsement, I never pass up an opportunity to recommend a Key and Peele sketch, but in honor of you being a Mickey, have you seen the Party Don't Stop sketch? You must have.
I have definitely seen the Party Don't Stop, yeah.
So it's a... basically, Key and Peele are playing LMFAO, but they're stuck in a music video where the party don't stop, and they keep trying to escape by like going out a door or a window or like crawling under a fire escape or something like that. Yeah. And they're just stuck in this purgatory of, you know, a party, basically. It's pretty great.
It's definitely very funny and probably how they felt.
Yeah, too close to home.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Okay, well, I don't really have a great one, so I'm going to do three not good ones. The first one is this. Did I ever talk about this pack of transitions I use in Premiere? They're called Handy Seamless Transitions.
No.
That I got from Video Hive, and they do like, it's just like the best fake whip pans and things. Mm-hmm. Like, I basically stopped doing whip pans on set because I can do them in post so easily and at the exact right time. And not have to have like the actor and the camera operator and all these people like perfectly in sync to get these camera transitions to work.
Do you find though that I'll do kind of like an in between where I'll just do a couple whips and then run the scene so that like I have so that my blur is the right combination of colors and things. You know what I mean?
Wow. No, I don't know if I've ever done that, but I wonder if that would work because like everything has to be right, like the camera position, the framing. But maybe it doesn't. I don't know. But
no, it's pretty forgiving, I feel.
Well, these fake ones, they just do like a horizontal blur.
Mm-hmm.
And then a D blur on the other side, horizontal D blur. And you can do diagonal, you can do anything. And there's like zoom transition. I mean, they're just like really solid. Like they look like a real whip pan. Like I said, so much so that.
You just don't even bother anymore.
Yeah.
Because you do a lot of whips, actually.
I like a whip pan. In a 30-second commercial, it's hard because every frame counts. And sometimes if you're like, literally she finishes saying the line and then like we wait like six frames too much before the whip pan starts. We're like, can we speed that up? Can we do that?
And
like,
you just cut them.
Well.
For sure.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could do that also. But that you might see like a little jump. I don't know. These fake whip pans are amazing.
I feel like, Matt, you're trying to say you're not recommending.
Yeah, I might. Maybe.
But, I'm going to show you them after this.
Also, I feel like fake whip pans, I feel like I can see. But I've watched everything you have made for the last 5 years and never once thought that. So
yeah, well, and a lot of times I'll have like real whip pans and then I'll add some fake ones because... like the client doesn't like the last two words on this line of dialogue, mm-hmm. you know? So anyhow, handy seamless transitions, they're called on Adobe Premiere. And do you guys always forget how to spell seamless? There's an A in it.
I had to think about it.
No, but there's plenty of words that I don't know how to spell.
Yeah, I write the word seamless like probably once a day. Like every treatment I've ever written has that word in it like seamless. 10 times.
Oh, it's a good word.
I don't think I use seamless in treatments. No. Really? I'll say energy.
Seamless.
Well, I use flow, juxtaposition, and seamless always. Like, it'll be like, we won't notice this happening. Or this is like
the marriage grounded.
Of these two things are it will be seamless. Like, yeah. you won't notice that.
Anthem is another good one.
Oh, yeah. This is interesting. That's a fun game.
What do you think anthem means? Because I actually had this argument with people on a commercial treatment call the other day.
Well,
they're like, we don't need an anthem spot. I'm like, when you say anthem spot, what do you mean by that?
Well, okay. Yeah, there are multiple ways to kind of categorize anthem. But I guess in terms of using it in a treatment, I would think that, you know, anthem is going to be like this grand, like the embodiment of like mm-hmm. whatever it is that it means. Like it's, you know, all in one here.
Mm-hmm. That's like a mission statement almost. Yeah.
Right. I think of like those iPhone spots where you see like people from 12 different countries using an iPhone. That's like an anthem spot.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, other people... don't think they think of it as like the main spot for the brand, and then like you can do cut downs. I don't know. Anyhow,
interesting.
The other thing I'm unendorsing or not endorsing is I watched all of Love is Blind. In like two sessions while I was like working on something on my computer. And
you can have Love is Blind. I'll always have The Circle.
So I watched The Circle too. I mean, you watch The Circle.
It's so dumb. It's so bad.
It's really dumb. Love is Blind, you think. Because everyone is talking about it, that it's going to go somewhere interesting. And it's just a Bachelor on speed, I guess. I don't know. Yeah.
So maybe I can plus your non-recommendation.
Yeah.
Well, if there's a way to spin how to recommend watching mm-hmm. Love is Blind, maybe it's the way I did it, where watch the first 20 minutes
mm-hmm.
and then just go to the last episode. Because I think you'll just get the show.
Yeah.
And
that's
you'll
funny.
Kind of. You're get like, everything, and then the best part is you get to kind of so who ended up together?
Sure, and you're a part of the conversation.
Yeah,
you're like okay. In a half an hour, you're caught up on everything that people are talking about.
Which really so many people reference Love is Blind. I was like, I got to see this show. I will say there's an excellent villain in it that I've never seen before.
Mm.
Jessica, do you know who she is?
I can't recall.
She is this woman who, wants to marry a guy that doesn't want to marry her, so she just like agrees to marry some other guy, and the entire rest of the show she's just bummed about being engaged to this guy. It's a disaster.
It sounds like exactly the type of person that would be on
sounds great.
But she's like so not self-aware, and she's like educated, has her own business, like super successful, but she's just like a wreck, and it's crazy. It's hard to watch. I feel really bad for the guy she's with.
I've got one more endorsement in honor of being three Bay Area, not natives, I guess, in your case, but locals for a certain point. The Goodby Silverstein masterclasses are a real treat, and there's a ton of, unlike other masterclasses, they're really getting to reference and watch all of the things they're talking about because it's a commercial. So you can watch.
Like 30 seconds.
Yeah. It's 30 seconds, and like licensing them isn't an issue. So like they did the Got Milk campaign, that Aaron Burr commercial that I talk about all the time. That's right. My favorite. Aaron Burr.
Classic.
Classic. Mm-hmm. Michael Bay directed. They talk about that. Mm-hmm. They talk about some incredible Oakland A's spots that are really good. So if you were a Northern California.
Wait, which ones? Because I feel like so there Oakland was a, A's had amazing spots.
There was a
spots.
Famous coach who was like a terror. He was just famously rude and terrible to everyone. And so they did these spots where he's just like a sweetheart. Mm. Like where he's like talking to an umpire and he's like, pardon me, but I happen to disagree from where I was standing, and forgive me for even bringing this up, but from where I was standing, that looked like a ball, you know, that sort of stuff. That, right. And they talk through the process and all that stuff. And so I think it's good for non-Northern Californians as well. But you realize that era of advertising is like really influential on like what funny commercials were to us as kids. Mm. Yeah, so it's pretty great. There's like a Chevy's commercial where they would go every single day and like hold up a newspaper and do a lie detector test to like a priest and be like, what's today? And they would say the date or whatever. And they'd be like, here we are at Chevy's making the food right now to like emphasize that like things were happening daily. There's all sorts of stuff like that that's like a real treat. So the Goodby Silverstein masterclass.
On masterclass.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Or Pirate Bay or whatever you steal things on, Oren.
Hey, I paid for Masterclass. My subscription just ended, so.
Yeah, yeah.
I legally should be able, like, it's much easier to borrow it than to get into a time machine and go to the time that I did have my subscription.
I had a real treat watching it, so.
Cool. Well, Mickey, if we want to find out more about you, MickeyFinnegan.com?
Yeah, MickeyFinnegan.com or any other social medias, it's all Mickey Finnegan.
Hey, look at that. Nice.
Cool. Well, if you want to ask us questions about Mickey, email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can also find everything we talked about on the podcast at justshootitpod.com. And you can find out about me. I'm at O Kaplan on Instagram.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow. This episode was edited by Jonathan Luna. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams, and you're listening to our outro music, which is by the artist Jazar and provided by the Free Music Archive.
We'll catch you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Goodbye.